All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And we're going right into our next live interview for the program with Peter Boyle, who is a member of Socialist Alliance and a writer for Green Left. And he recently wrote an article titled "After the Referendum, Don't Agonise, Organise." Discussing the kind the results of the Voice to Parliament referendum that took place last Saturday. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Jacob. I'm speaking to you from Gadigal land. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Yeah. So, Peter, I want to kind of hear, maybe to kind of start off, I want to kind of hear some of your initial thoughts, like drawing on the article that you wrote about, you know, how should, you know, left-wing and progressive people and, you know, supporters of First Nations rights, you know, respond to the result of the Voice to referendum, which, you know, you described in your article as something that most First Nations people have felt that the result is as a slap in the face.
Yeah, I think that's totally understandable. I mean, most First Nations people would feel that this was an overwhelming rejection by a majority of the population for, you know, an extremely modest proposal for constitutional recognition and to re-establish a First Nations advisory body to Parliament and government. And, you know, so, I mean, in one sense, so little was asked for, and yet a majority in every state, I think ACT was the only territory in which there was a majority for yes, you know, basically rejected it. But it has to be said, you know, nearly all previous constitutional referendums have failed. I mean, this is notoriously hard to win. And yes, you have to admit, the Australian population at this stage is by and large conservative and apolitical. But furthermore, this specific referendum result was well predicted by nearly all the opinion polls in the lead up to October 14. So, you know, in one sense, the result shouldn't have been a surprise to anybody. Interestingly, the same polls showed that at the beginning of the campaign, the yes side had 60% of the vote, but it steadily lost that ground over the course of the campaign, basically reversing the situation. So, starting with 60% for yes and 40% for no, it was reversed to, you know, 40% yes, in actual fact slightly less, and 60% no. So how do we explain this trajectory? Now, I think it has to be said that the official no campaign from the very start was unashamedly tapping, pressing the racist, using the racist arguments, if not directly, tapping it in an indirect way. It really played to racism in an unashamed way. So I would say this is a reason why we can't explain what happened, the reversal of the numbers, the balance over the course of the campaign, purely by saying, well, you know, this is a very racist country, you've got entrenched racism, and that's the reason for it. Though there is no doubt that racism was a big part of the result. I think that the shift that took place over the campaign really has to be blamed on the Yes campaign, because it was like it had a major flaw in it for the start. Because on one hand, it was designed to be so minimalist and conservative in the hope by its architects of getting bipartisan support, so support from the coalition as well as Labor, because, you know, the understanding was that, you know, you can't actually win a constitutional referendum in Australia or in current conditions or in the conditions of the last, decades, unless you have bipartisan support. However, it failed to get that bipartisan support and yet continued as though, you know, that was the game plan. And consequently, you know, it was highly contradictory in the arguments it floated. It made huge promises that simply did not match the limited nature of its proposals. For example, it was suggesting that, you know, simply by having constitutional recognition, which we already have in every single state constitution, and by establishing an advisory body, which we have in some states, would somehow close the gap between First Nations people and the rest of the population. I mean, you'd really either not be paying attention or you'd be extremely naive to think that that would do the job. So it was basically based on a lie. And the more the campaign seemed to not get traction, the more it went on with this rhetorical, oh, this is your last chance, you know, this is going to do it. Completely ridiculous thing. So I think it was very unconvincing. I think at one stage, Noel Pearson, who was, you know, leading light of the Yes campaign, even said, you know, thinking this was a winning argument, oh, well, white people can then blame First Nations people if the gap's not closed, if you give us a voice to Parliament. I mean, what kind of argument is that, honestly? I think observing all the arguments and what Noel Pearson said is a very good way of really coming to the guts of what the problem was here. Just before the vote, Noel Pearson did a private meeting with the elite King School in Sydney and Gadi, and he made this statement, which was reported in a number of newspapers. He said, frankly, the Voice is a proposal so pathetically understated that I'm amazed that Indigenous people are settling for it. After all, he said, I helped design it as something so modest so no reasonable non-Indigenous person could reject it. More fool me. That's what he said. So he admitted it from the start. He spent all his time, he said, basically in discussion with Conservatives. First of all, with former Prime Minister John Howard. And, you know, they basically cooked up the essential proposal from that. So he was felt a bit betrayed because Noel Pearson, of course, used to be the First Nation darling of the right, right? He was a lawyer, and he made his name basically attacking the so-called left for allegedly inculcating a sense of victimhood into First Nations people and making them dependent on welfare. Now, you can imagine, you know, he was saying that, and in the context of the neoliberal right-wing offensive that's been, you know, besetting Australia and other countries for decades now, Noel Pearson was, you know, he was welcomed as the voice of the future for First Nations people. He was given platforms and, you know, Financial Review, the Australian, you know, right-wing think tanks. Everybody wanted to promote him. So he was the poster boy of the right, really. But now, of course, he's been supplanted by other poster people, Jacinta Price and Warren Mundine. They're the ones that they now favour.
Just before we talk a little bit more about that, I think the point that you raise here is a really critical one, Peter, about Pearson himself saying this was such a weak proposal and I don't understand why Aboriginal people didn't reject it. I mean, we know that there were quite prominent black activists who did reject it. Probably most famously is Lydia Thorpe leading the Progressive No, but she was not alone. There was a lot of other people, including Robbie Thorpe here at 3CR. One of the hosts was like quite insistent on a Progressive No sort of case. In that context, that there was not bipartisan support for this referendum, do you think that if the referendum had been more substantial and had promised more, and I don't know exactly what that would have looked like, maybe guaranteed funding for Aboriginal community organisations, treaty, a promise to implement the findings of the recommendations of the Royal Commission into Black Deaths in Custody, if the campaign had been more substantial, do you think that actually it may have gained more vigorous support from progressives and from the Aboriginal community and therefore may have had a better chance of getting up?
Well, in actual fact, a number of people who were in the Progressive No camp, including Lydia Thorpe and Michael Mansell, have indicated that, you know, if it had been a proposal that was more substantial, it would have their support. Now, I should say, of course, I mean, most of your readers probably know this, that I was making the point that, you know, this whole Yes campaign was a creature of the most conservative wing of the First Nations community of, you know, if you want to call it leaders in inverted commas, whereas virtually all the leadership, or, you know, 90% of the leadership of the militant grassroots section of the First Nations community leadership were in the Progressive No camp. So, I mean, that was a contrast that, of course, struck everybody from the beginning of the campaign. And yet, the way a lot of people who were supporting the Yes campaign were carrying on, it was almost like they were in denial. They kept on with the pretense, and this was another core lie in the whole campaign, that somehow that the very limited conservative proposals of the campaign were coming from as a unanimous voice from First Nations people, and that was not true, and everybody could see it was not true. Yet they kept repeating it over and over and over again. I think that was pathetic. Now, you know, two things. One is that, you know, maybe not everybody in the Progressive No side would have come at an amended, more ambitious proposal. But there were things that were said. For instance, Lydia did say, you know, if the government had negotiated with her and actually made some proposals to deliver some concrete rights, say on death in custody, for instance, you know, she would come to the table. Michael Mansell said, and Michael Mansell's not the only one, says, you know, rather than have an advisory body that, you know, can just simply, you know, okay, we've listened to you, we've ticked that box and we'll carry on and do what we want, he prefers a system a bit like in Aotearoa, New Zealand, where there are designated seats for First Nations people, for Maori people. Because he basically then says, and you know, there's a lot of strength in this argument, you know, let's not be naive, you know, what's advice? What difference is advice going to make? What difference has it made in the past? But if you actually have a guaranteed First Nations voice in Parliament, you have a point from which you can fight, you know, a point from which you can campaign. So that's the logic of that. Second question is that, of course, if the Labor government had been willing to make the what would seem to have been the obvious adjustment, if you don't have bipartisan support, you know, go for something better, would that have won a majority support in the referendum? Would have been interesting, wouldn't it? I mean, I think it would have meant that you'd have to have a different kind of campaign, a campaign that had a lot more truth-telling in it instead of a whole pile of bullshit-telling. Certainly people would have had to move along. But, you know, in the history of politics, that's how opinion changes. You have a vigorous debate, a discussion. You tell the truth. Home truths come in. People start to change, young people first. And that was another point which, I mean, so striking about the election result. You know, and this is the silver lining, if you like. You know, I think to the extent that you say that the raw yes vote from the non-First Nations people was by and large people wanting in some sort of vague way to be on the side of First Nations people, to give respect and recognition to that position. To that extent, the fact that overwhelmingly young people were voting yes, I think is a sign of hope. It reaffirms what many of us have seen in the streets for the last few years, particularly on Invasion Day. Mm. You know, these huge crowds of people, mostly young people, right? They could fight for something more concrete. I mean, they had thin offerings. They had vote yes or vote no, and they said, of course, we're going to vote yes because we don't want to be Peter Dutton and the racists. But if there had been a more ambitious campaign, could they have been mobilized, you know, a bit more enthusiastically than the kind of formal mobilization that the official Yes campaign, which has by and large called upon the Labor ranks, you know?
Hmm. I want to go into kind of, I think, because I think there's been a lot of kind of great points to kind of, that are kind of raised there. And I think one sort of important takeaway that actually I think we should take from the referendum, and in the context of Zane's question and your response to it, Peter, I think that, you know, what the campaign kind of reflects is it's almost sort of like the inability of the ALP to challenge racism. In fact, they're not even willing to actually put a kind of anti-racist argument. Although that said, you know, you could, there's an argument to be made. And of course, this is what some of the progressive no activists kind of allude to, you know, because of the, is that, you know, one of the problems as well is that the ALP are the same party, you know, state governments are basically introducing repressive laws that, you know, target First Nations people.
Building new jails.
There's also the fact that one of the biggest sponsors of the Yes campaign was Rio Tinto. And I also think that, you know, I think there is a level of kind of demoralization around the result, but I do think that, you know, you raise this kind of a point that, you know, conservative ideas often kind of dominate most of the time under capitalism because the ruling class has ample means to keep people depoliticized, confused and divided. But I think, you know, you conclude with the point that we can't be demoralized by this result. We actually have to organize. And I guess, what are some of your comments on the things that need to be done in order to fight, you know, to fundamentally fight for First Nations rights, especially addressing the failures of the ALP in mounting this official Yes campaign?
Yeah, well, I think truth-telling, you could say, is going to be a part of it. I mean, first of all, look, if the result, you know, if you want to read the result in the most negative way possible, Australian people are incorrigibly racist, you know, and conservative, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if we want to change society, we've got to start from understanding what the real situation is. No point fooling ourselves, right? So I think the first step is to recognize the reality. And part of that reality, of course, is that, look, the Labor Party is not on our side. I mean, it was clear. That was as clear as mud as well through the campaign, because on one hand, you got all this kind of like, oh, you know, going to close the gap, last chance, it's historical chance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, of course, as you have said, Labor governments, state and federal, were at the same time attacking First Nations rights, you know, on the federal level as well. You know, I mean, they were supporting the mining companies against several Indigenous communities, you know, gas mining companies, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Then there's the West Australian one. Yeah, you know, how embarrassing is that? That photograph of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese in the Rio Tinto shirt. I mean, for God's sake, you know. And at the same time, not only Rio Tinto destroying the Juukan Gorge rock shelters, 46,000-year-old, you know, proof of continuous First Nations occupation of this area. But also then the Labor government in Western Australia backflipping on its own response in terms of toughening Indigenous heritage protection laws. And, yeah, the shocking thing, I thought, when the Queensland Labor government, you know, did that legalise locking up young people in police lockups, you know. Mm. I mean that, you know, yeah, how disgraceful. I mean, how dare a Labor Party person say we want to say end First Nations deaths in custody? If Australia continues to lock up young people, overwhelmingly First Nations people, from the time they are 14, 13, whatever, you know, that just guarantees that the future First Nations deaths in custody are going to even spiral even more. It's going to be even higher than it is today, because it is in exact proportion to the disproportionate incarceration of First Nations people. And everybody knows now that the numbers are shocking, because not only the adult First Nations population is overrepresented, the youth First Nations people are doubly overrepresented. So you might as well be condemning a future generation of First Nations people to death in custody by doing this. So we've got to recognise the facts. I think that's the that's the first part. And therefore, I don't feel like, you know, I mean, I understand that people feel a bit sad and feel a bit demoralised now. But look, facts are facts, you know. And actually, we can learn out of all this. We can learn how to fight better in a future campaign.
All right. Well, do you have any kind of final comments that you'd like to make, Peter?
I think that, you know, I'm already feeling like the, you know, the sort of like the mourning side is already passing. I don't think actually, you know, it was hard to predict in advance, you know, and the first couple of days after, you could literally feel it. But honestly, for most First Nations people, there really is no time for this kind of agonizing. There never has been time. Yeah? You know, stuff is going on all the time. Many people are in, you know, from one week to the next, many First Nations families lurch from one crisis to another, the sorry business coming and going, you know. One more slap in the face is just one more slap in the face. So I feel more and more confident that this is not going to have a long-lasting effect. The most important thing is that, you know, that that part of the truth-telling that we're going to come into has got to be truth-telling about what happened here. Now, the Labor Party, I think, does deserve a lot of scrutiny, because you cannot tell me that they didn't have internal polling that told them exactly what was going to happen, and yet they persisted. And why? And I think, and this is the point, my final point here, and a point that I made in the article, is that I think it's entirely legitimate for First Nations people to feel like they have been the political football here between the major parties. Because I think the Labor Party, at a certain level, has calculated that they were prepared to lose this referendum, but gain some things. One, you know, they gained the sort of like the posture position of, well, we tried. Second thing is that they've actually created a double wedge. They have wedged the Liberal Party, or the Dutton leadership, because, as you know, most of the seats that Liberals lost to the Teals, they all voted overwhelmingly yes. So Dutton's got a problem now in regaining those seats. Secondly, and this to a slightly less extent, they succeeded in wedging the Greens. Because through this campaign, I would say, once the break with Lydia Thorpe happened, the Greens basically tailed the Labor Party. They were ineffective. In almost every other sphere of politics in Australia today, the Greens actually appear as a significant, quite sharp opposition to the Labor government. But on this question, they were wedged into tailing the Labor Party. So I feel like, you know, if First Nations people got a right to feel like they were used, they were kicked around the football, and that the Labor government actually calculates that in the end, they may very well win out of this loss, if you like. And there's been precedent for this, people have said. Many other governments have put forward constitutional referendum, lost it, and gone on to win the subsequent election.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that, Peter. And I think, I think those are all kind of very important kind of takeaway points to take away from the referendum result. But, yeah, thank you very much, Peter, for being on our program.
Yeah, cheers.
Thanks, James and Jacob.